his CAM license, but he would go on and on about, you know, UFOs and that type of thing. You know, he was way out there. And, you know, you get people that are somewhat credible when you put them on, you know, speaking to Congress, and the next thing you know, you've got this, you got the whole population interested in this bizarre topic, which, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, is a real waste of time, a waste of money. That thing has been proven over and over again that they don't have anything like that. And not one person has ever brought back an artifact or, you know, anything, a wheel or you know, space laser gun or something, nothing. So it's really bizarre. But Art Bell, he had a call letter. I think he came out of California. But anyway, back to you.
I just recall a no time travel, no perpetual motion of any kind, and no anti-gravity. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, some people kind of fudge around and say that any force that opposes gravity is anti-gravity. That's really not what anti-gravity means. Usually when people use the term anti-gravity, they mean some kind of method of shielding the massive objects from each other, from experiencing gravitational forces on each other. But yeah, I would agree with it. By the way, obviously Art Bell has shuffled off his mortal coil, and he didn't really have any credentials. He was just a radio show host. This is some jerk called David Grush. Apparently, he is a former U.S. intelligence official, which only goes to show that we probably need to check out who we've employed. He's been doing this scam for years now, and he'll probably keep on doing it until he runs out of money or something. I don't know. It's kind of ludicrous. I mean, if you're prepared to tell people things like this, you need proof. You can't simply say that a bunch of guys told you so, because it's a bunch of guys who told other people a lot of things that don't exist. You know, I mean, the premise is completely absurd. So, you know, the first thing they probably should have done, you know, if they were working with their own minds, I asked this guy, Bruce, do you have any actual proof? In which he'd say no, in which they'd say, oh, thank you very much, now go away. But instead, they kind of make a farce of congressional committees. I mean, you know, what's next? Bigfoot? Santa? I don't know.
There was some time you were talking with Dick about parallel universe, so that would be the exemption for the time travel eventually, if you could, because you would never meet your past. Eventually, if you could think about it, right? But there are certain things we cannot change. Science doesn't recognize spirituality at all. It doesn't want to talk about it. So, if we're talking about anti-gravity, if there is no way to fight gravity, if we move to the parallel universe, what would be possible then? Back to you.
No, it doesn't really work out well that way either, unless you want to. This idea of parallel universes comes from the quantum mechanical concept of the many worlds, in which the quantum wave function has almost infinite solutions, and then when something happens to collapse the wave function, it resolves itself to a single state. So, you know, like in Schrodinger's cat type of thing, if you toss a coin and have it land in a box, it is theoretically both heads and tails until you collapse or the coin wave function by opening the box and seeing that it either has or tails, or it's stuck on its edge, which would be fascinating. So with the parallel universes, as far as gravity is concerned, you would have to posit a universe with different different physical constants in which the forces and interactions were different. But the problem with gravity, as we presently know it, is gravity is really not a force. It's an interaction based on the curvature of space-time itself. So you would have to do something to space-time to have it seem as though it was anti-gravity, which is a kind of difficult thing to wrap your head around, even with a parallel universe.
I found arguments against the time travel. I'm going to read it. There are too many issues which makes us think that the equations may be unrealistic. The first issue is practical. One, building the time machine seems to require exotic matter, which is matter in negative energy. All matter we see in our daily life is positive energy. Matter with negative energy is not something you can just find lying around. From quantum mechanics, we know that such matter can theoretically be created, but in too small quantities and for the short period of time. Your comment?
Well, negative energy, the problem is that physics and quantum mechanics is basically written in not English or German or Russian, but in mathematics. And just because you can write an equation doesn't necessarily mean it models reality as we know it. If you take math and give it imaginary mass, if you give an object imaginary mass and you keep the equations perfectly the same, you get things that have been called tachyons, which have very weird characteristics because they probably don't exist because there's no such thing as imaginary mass. The same thing with negative energy. There may or may not be any real things such as negative energy. Negative energy kind of fits into other weird ideas, equations. I talked earlier about wormholes. Wormholes are kind of ruptures of space-time that kind of spiral in. It's totally theoretical. They haven't demonstrated it in any way, shape, or form. The problem is even the theoretical model would narrow down to a diameter that would be shorter than a subatomic particle. So you might theoretically be able to get a wormhole, but you couldn't put anything through it because it would grow too narrow. And the way to theoretically widen out the wormhole is to insert negative energy, whatever that is, into the wormhole. So you get around a theoretical constraint with a theoretical item. Lots of luck with that. So yeah, it's negative energy just gives me a rash. I don't like when physicists kind of make up stuff completely out of whole cloth.
Okay, so we don't have a time travel. I wonder if our space professional could say a few words about the black holes and its structure.
Hey,
to you, Paul.
Yeah, it crackled a little bit. I know he asked me a question, or he wanted me to comment on something. What was it, Wesley?
Black holes and its structure.
Oh, black holes in general? Well, when we were younger, as far as we were concerned, they didn't exist. They were just theory. But now they exist. Now we know they truly exist. And not only do regular black holes exist, but supermassive black holes exist in the centers of many, many galaxies. Most galaxies that they look at now, they believe, has a supermassive black hole involved with it, including our own. So, you take
who was it, Vera, she was a scientist, well, she would look at all the plates of the photographs, and she eventually showed that, you know, all these different different lights, you know, in the sky surrounding the center of the galaxy, everything was moving at a different rate, you know, and you take those kinds of theories, which eventually led to, you know, what we have today with the spinning of the galaxies, and, you know, why the stars on the outside don't match the spinning on the inside, and over time, they, you know, scientists looked at the center of our galaxy, they could see stars were really moving quick, and they knew that in the middle was a black hole. So, you know, at least we know they exist, Wesley. I can go on and on, but back to you.
Does the black hole expand, and what is its limitation in expansion?
Does it do what before it goes into an expansion? Does it collapse? It goes to a singularity. We know that, which is nothing but a mathematical term for, you know, things that normally would work out mathematically don't work out in the middle of a singularity. I mean, actually, if you look at the Earth and the latitude and longitude lines, you know, coming to the poles, when you get down to the poles, the mathematics really don't work out. They actually consider the North Pole and South Pole a singularity. So, you know, with the black holes, same thing, you know, we know that things go inside of it, but mathematically, we don't know the end results. It's just theories. Some people think there's a white hole at the other end, you know, you're going to go into the black hole and just keep on going and pop out on another part of the universe on what they call a white hole. So, you know, there's all kinds of theories, and I've read about them, and I'm sure you have it too. Also, Wesley, back to you.
K-A-T. Yep.
Say again?
K-A-2-U-T-F?
Yes, what would you like to say?
Did anyone ever hear of the smallest black hole being one Planck length?
Well, I mean, that's a theoretical construct once again, because the idea is nothing can be smaller than a Planck length. So if you had a theoretical micro black hole, it would be the length of a Planck length. Because black holes' life expectancy is directly related to its mass, though, its existence would probably be a Planck second before it evaporated in Hawking radiation.
QSL, and do we use that as more or less the smallest possible unit of measurement, right?
Yep, that's the idea.
Roger. Okay, that's all I wanted to clarify.
Oh, okay, no problem. Now, black holes are fascinating objects. Your black hole can be massively large, and that's a problem in our English language. When we say that a black hole is massively large, what we're actually describing is the event horizon of the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole, which is the point in space that the escape velocity is the speed of light. And so anything that's farther into that region of space-time is going to go into it and never get out, other than through Hawking's radiation. So you can have massively large black hole event horizons.
One last comment?
Certainly.
Given this whole constellation of things that are being considered, wouldn't you think that if we hold to the idea that the speed of light is inviolate, that the whole idea of an alien spacecraft on Earth becomes pretty absurd?
Well, not necessarily. It makes it somewhat absurd, but not totally absurd. We talked about relativistic speeds. And as long as, if you are able to travel close to relativistic speeds, I mean, everyone you know and love may have died of extreme old age, But time slows down for you, the space traveler. So if you were insane, you could theoretically get into a ship that had accelerators that went very close to the speed of light in the vacuum and have time dilation allow you to survive and get to the Earth. Again, all your friends, relatives, your planet would probably be a dust mote if you ever went back because of the relative time difference. But it's still theoretically possible. And the speed of light in the vacuum is more of a quality of space-time itself than just of light. Light is kind of instantaneous in the medium of space-time, and space-time itself has a causality speed limit of the speed of light in the vacuum.
Yeah, but if we're to assume that nothing can pop in and out of existence, ex nihilo, as it were, and if we're also to assume that any spacecraft that would be approaching our planet would be coming from some other planet as opposed to some murky, theoretical netherworld, that the speed of light idea would have to hold. It wouldn't matter how much time dilation you have. You wouldn't have, unless some living organism can actually persist for thousands and millions of years.
No, you're missing the point. We can't accelerate to the speed of light because anything that has non-zero mass simply can't. The amount of energy required to accelerate an object with mass to the speed of light is an infinite amount of energy. So it's only rest massless objects like photons that can travel through time-space at the speed of light. But you can theoretically travel at 99% of the speed of light, and for you locally, you would see the universe kind of speed up as your sense of the time slowed down. So in your, quote, lifetime, traveling at close to the speed of light, you could have a normal lifetime and you can actually reach a very distant planet. The time schemes for everyone else will be screwed up entirely, and it probably is a useless thing to do. There are better ways of committing suicide. But I mean, theoretically, based on relativity, you can travel from one distant planet to another in your local lifespan as long as you're dilating time enough to kind of get to point A, point B much faster in your time scheme than the rest of the universe out there.
All right, say the traveler in his time reference is able to reach 99% the speed of light and is traveling from what we would consider to be the nearest possibly habitable planet. Would an ordinary time, even with time dilation taken into consideration, afford you time to reach Earth?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, the problem is it's impractical because you would need a near infinite amount of energy in order to accelerate and decelerate to those very high velocities. So it's more of a mind, game than anything else. But theoretically, if you travel close enough to the speed of light, your time sense will dilate to the point where for every million years the galaxy goes ticking away, only an hour went by for you. And all the other Lorentzian transforms that occur at relativistic speeds will happen in the direction of the distance that you're traveling. The length will contract and the width will dilate. So all kinds of weird aspects of relativistic physics go into Lorentz transformations. But it is theoretically possible to slow down your own traveling through time. You know, you travel through the planet's time all over the place, but your limited 50-year, 60-year, 70-year life expectancy can be encapsulated in a much longer external time that goes on because of the differences in your velocity versus the galaxy.
Right, I'm just somebody would have to sit down and do the calculation, but I was just wondering what your 70-year life expanse will afford you in terms of time, you know, distance traveled, you know, in, if you reach the 99% the speed of light framework, would that give you enough distance over the expanse of space to reach from, you know, some star that's X number of light years away? I guess your answer is yes. Okay, so I just wonder, you know, what the exchange rate is, 1 year for how many years at 99% the speed of light.
Well, yeah, I mean, there must be some Lorentz transform equation websites where you plug in things like that, and it'll give you some semblance of information. Ultimately, the ultimate gotcha that you have in this situation is the humongous amount of energy that you would either need to pick up on the trip or carry. That would amount to an almost infinite amount of mass, which would make it require you to put in more energy, which would require more mass, which would require more energy. So the trick is getting to these velocities. If you could magic up getting close to relativistic speed, the time dilation will fix that one little problem. But getting there is a very big problem. It's pretty much impossible. It's all a theoretical mind game that people play with each other.
Okay, could you say a few words about the time difference for the people traveling in space right now and the people on the Earth? They get a little bit younger. It's not younger. They're not older that much. But,
yeah, I mean, the bottom line is time is relative. Time is not set. So the rate that time passes is not uniform, unfortunately. We talked about this a few weeks ago when I brought up the GPS. The GPS requires some degree of understanding of the general theory of relativity in that time travels slower on the surface of the Earth than it does on the GPS satellites because they're farther away from the center of Earth's gravity. So they have less of a distortion in space-time, and so they travel through time at a slightly different rate. And the same thing happens with objects that are traveling at different relative velocities. Time passes to at different rates. So on the surface, things are a little bit slower than things sitting on the GPS satellite. So and the rest is that gravitational fields are sort of have the same effect as accelerating objects like rocket ships.
Dr. Roy, did you hear about Stephen Hawking's chronology protection conjecture, which states that time travel should not be possible, but it was still not proven?
Well, I mean, all these things are highly experimental. There's very little practical way of testing a lot of these things. I mean, just again, on a logistics, there's nothing inherently that violates logic of traveling forward through time. It's the traveling back, because, you know, one of the major laws of increase in entropy and such requires the direction of time. If it's cause effect, if you are able to go back in time, then you can have effect produces a cause, which again is a logistical problem. So a lot of people have a lot of clever ideas about time. Hawking had an idea that the beginning of the universe and the Big Bang was actually outside of the constraints of space-time, and so it was kind of meaningless to say that there was no time before the universe was created in the Big Bang. So there's a lot of interesting theoretical physics out there.
In other words, back in time is impossible. We go in the to the future. Well, we may say it's possible. Because if it's a difference in time due to us traveling at a certain speed, then we're going to the future, only that we don't know nothing that happened on the Earth at the time. So we cannot change anything. right or wrong?
Well, I mean, it depends upon your means of communication. That would be another fly in the ointment. You couldn't really affect anything because you would be traveling at relativistic speeds where you can't really interact that much with the Earth. You'd be in a different time frame. So, you know, by the time you said a word, you know, 150 years might have passed on the Earth. You know, no one has the patience for something like that. So, but I mean, ultimately, we're all traveling forward through time. I mean, that's what we do. We do it every day. You know, when I sat down here, it was 8 o'clock, now it's 10:35. So I'm traveling through time.
Yeah, there is over $1 billion still to win in Mega. So I'm very much unhappy that I cannot go back in time. So I could go in front. I mean, to go to the future, see the numbers go back, but I cannot do it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Leslie. Thanks as always for participating. You know, in a way, theoretically again, not very practically, you could kind of see the past because seeing things is electromagnetic waves. Electromagnetic waves just go out and out and out. Theoretically, if you had something incredibly sensitive that could focus in to far distant light waves that were originally bounced off the Earth, you could see the fall of the Roman Empire, theoretically. It would just be a silent movie, but it would be an interesting movie nevertheless. Anyway, thanks for everyone who participated tonight. Surprisingly, it went longer than I thought. Please forgive me, Paul. We're going to have the SpaceNet report with WS2N.
Before you go, Dr. Roy, just one thing. Actually, I found how to go back in time. I do. I really do. Look, if you're looking at the light coming from a billion years ago, today, through the Hubble telescope, you're actually seeing things from the past and not 2 days ago, billion years ago, right or wrong.
Yes, indeed. It's kind of the same thing written very large. We do not really have the ability to see distant objects in real time. Everything, past a certain point is some number of years in the past. And especially when you get towards the edges of the observable universe, you're seeing things that happened 13 plus billion years ago. So, yeah, you can see the past. You can't really go into it, but you can see images from the past.
Thank you very much, Paul. Pick up.
Yeah, take it away, Paul.
Okay, very good. Thanks, guys. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, you're looking at the moon. That's not there. Because it's already 2 seconds old. I always got a kick out of that one. And I mentioned Vera Rubin before. She's one of the astronomers that they focused on in the book, The Astronomers. It's an older book, but it's a large book. It tells you the history of all of the astronomers and all the discoveries that they made, from day one all the way up into, dark matter and all. Like, she was instrumental in figuring out about dark matter, and that led to other thoughts, and Hawkins coming up with black hole theories. But if you get a chance to read The Astronomers, very good book. Let me drop it. DW message, go by. The recent flight of the Falcon Heavy that took off yesterday, it was delayed a few days. I was watching it a few nights ago. It was supposed to go up at 11:04 at night, and it aborted 1 minute and 6 seconds before flight. And unfortunately, SpaceX is a private company. They don't necessarily explain details of what went wrong, what the problem was, and they delayed it another day as well. And they finally took off yesterday. And it's a Falcon Heavy. It's the that's the one where you have the center core of a Falcon 9 rocket, and then you have a port and starboard Falcon 9 rocket attached to it as well. So it's essentially three in one. With each Falcon 9 has nine Merlin the engines. This one has 27. But the goal of this one was to put a satellite into geosynchronous orbit. It's the heaviest one that they've put up into geosynchronous orbit so far. The thing weighed 20,000 pounds, so it's a huge thing, over 20,000 pounds. So you know, it's like a 10-ton satellite, and at 23,000 miles above the surface of the Earth, that's an incredible feat. And the Falcon Heavy really did its job, and it's the seventh one that SpaceX has launched over the years. But it was successful, and it will be a communication satellite, you know, everything from broadband to, regular gigantic communication satellite. The solar panels are going to open up hundreds of feet in each direction. You know, once it's first turned on, they have to commission it and get it up and running. But it's going to be situated over North America. Prime, you know, over the equator, but you know, it'll be used mostly by, you know, America or even Central America. So that hopefully that'll come on and bring on a lot of people that presently are having trouble with communications, especially, you know, Alaska and parts of Canada. Should help. It'll also be used for people flying in jets or on cruise ships, get on the internet. WS2N. Anyway, that's a record for the largest mass being put into a geosynchronous orbit. The couple of the other topics I have is DARPA and NASA got together, and now they're starting to fund a nuclear rocket. I don't know if anybody saw this on the NASA site, but they talked about funding nuclear rockets. They've got Lockheed Martin as the builders of this thing. And the idea is to eventually create a rocket that will be eventually manned, you know, that they need to be able to increase the speeds to getting to places like Mars. Right now it would take roughly 6 months to get to Mars. Roughly 6 months to get back. If you were, let's say, halfway there and you decided you needed to abort and you wanted to turn around with chemical rockets, that's really not possible. But with this thing, you could do it. It's a fission rocket. Fission will be a fission engine. And what they do is they heat up, well, there's going to be a lot of liquid hydrogen on board. And they take that, they take this, the heat from the fission reaction, just the heat, and it's enough to expand this hydrogen at really a very fast speed out the exhaust. And instead of whatever speed they're traveling, let's say to Mars, they have to get up to 25,000 miles per hour to break the influence of gravity around Earth. And that's what they usually do, try to get up to around 28,000 miles an hour. And then from there all the way to Mars, they're actually starting to slow down. That's why it takes so long to get there. But this thing, you could, you know, keep the engine going. You could get a much higher speed. They're predicting four times faster than what they're doing now. Time will tell. But at least they know they can cut that time down to Mars instead of 6 months, maybe 3 months. And they also have the possibility of, you know, abort, let's go back, you know. One of the astronauts needs real serious medical help. We have a doctor on board, but we need a lot of doctors to fix this problem. Let's turn this thing around. They'll be able to do that with this thermonuclear system, a fission system. It's not, you know, you're not creating fusion. It's fission, heat, and an exhaust. that's one system that they're actually going to start funding. They want to send up a, let's see, a rocket. Well, just this will be unmanned. They would like to send a test rocket up by 2027. How they're going to do this in 4 years, I don't know. But that's the present plan. They've already released the money for them to develop this thing. They had pictures on the internet, and we'll see how they do over time. Any comments? WS2N. Yes, John, go ahead. How are you doing?
Doing well. Hope you're doing also. When they tried this with airplanes, determined that the shielding necessary to protect the pilots or cargo or really anything near this reactor was, which made it impossible to develop an aircraft for the weight and size and mass of all this shielding. I'm guessing that's less of a concern, you know, obviously in space. Weight and size may not be as much of a concern, but are they going to assemble it, you know, out in orbit, or are they going to launch this massive thing with all this lead shielding directly as one unit?
Well, because of environmental concerns, they are going to wait until it's in orbit before this thing is, you know, the final touches will be put on it and turned on. It's not going to be turned on in the Earth's atmosphere, that's for sure. So you'll have a standard conventional chemical rocket, you know, like the Space Launch System, you know, would be able to launch this thing into orbit. And the reactor is really at the tail end, and I'm sure they'll probably have some kind of design where there's a big separation between that fission rocket and the living quarters, and I would imagine there's going to be some kind of real heavy-duty, I don't know if it's going to be lead, but maybe, you know, some kind of shielding. But there would be a distance from it, you know, they'll be at the very top of it. By the drawing, it looks like they'll probably be 50 feet away from the, at least 50 feet away from the reactor itself. But we'll see. We'll see how their designs come out. And yeah, the main concern is environmental. You know, the last thing they need is to have this thing go up and then not make it to orbit and then worry about contamination. I remember when Cassini went up, you probably might remember that too, John, that there was protests and things. They had RTGs on board, radioisotope thermoelectric generator systems on Cassini. There was all kinds of protests, let me drop. And then, you know, finally they were able to launch it. They proved to the public that, you know, you could take this thing and hit it with a tank. They slammed it to the ground, you know, the container as tests at thousands of miles an hour, you know, and they proved that this thing would never crack open. So I would imagine it's going to be this, you know, similar thing here. They're going to have to be able to get any kind of nuclear stuff into space more often as time goes on, especially with the Artemis program. They're going to need generators on the moon. So, they're going to have to get around the problems that we worried about in the 70s and 80s and even the early 90s. We'll see. Back to you, John.
Yeah, understood. Roger that. You know, technology's come a long way. They've learned a lot. Unfortunately, much of what they learned is obvious to do with the accident. But okay, yeah, interesting. I'll be curious to see the drawing, sketches, kind of design and just as it goes on. I'm certainly not an expert on it, but I have read about when they tried to develop the aircraft. But, you know, keeping an aircraft with enough engine to keep moving constantly through air is much different than space, I imagine. We're probably talking about something smaller. I don't know. I'm very curious about the whole thing. Just thought of that as you were talking. So that's my only comment, is that the airplane idea was impossible. They figured out eventually. Maybe they had an idea from the beginning, but they had to abandon the project just due to size and weight constraints. Popped into my head. All right, real good. WS Good from KC2. Thank you, sir.
Very good, John. And the airplane project, it rings a bell that you mentioned it, but I don't really remember that. Any details with that? They did have a NERVA program. They called it NERVA. That was back with, I guess, with Reagan and Star Wars. And even before that, I think in the 60s, they were thinking about launching directly from Earth with a similar type of thing where you would have a nuclear fission and it would heat up hydrogen and, you know, blast off from Earth. But then, you know, that, I don't think that ever went anywhere. I think they tested it out in the middle of, who knows, maybe out where you are, John. I don't know. I seem to remember they did a test on one of these engines. And, you know, it's an idea that's been around forever. I particularly like the idea of taking a nuclear fission and creating heat out of it and having the heat be used for, electric power, you know, to drive like the Zion engines they're making nowadays. Right now you have SEP programs, SEP rockets in space successfully flying all over the place. SEP is solar electric propulsion. So instead of the solar, you know, I would have nuclear. And I think that would be maybe a good way to go as well. But right now there's no contracts given out for that. Just for this one, nuclear, taking liquid hydrogen, heating that, and using that for thrust. And Lockheed, you know, they do a lot of weird things, so I guess if anybody could do it, they could do it. Any other comments from anybody else, including Sean? This is WS2N. Okay. This is going to be an Antares Cygnus launch from Virginia this Tuesday, and it'll be a nighttime launch. It's 8:31. This leaves John out anyway, but if you're on Long Island or New Jersey, the deal is if you go out at 8:31 and look very low on the horizon, you can't have any buildings or trees in the way. Because it's not going to, when the rocket goes up, it's not going to get that high in elevation over the horizon. But, you know, it might go up, you know, 15, 20 degrees, depending on where you're located. Should be about that for Long Island, so I'd have to, there's too many trees and houses by me, but I'd have to go down by the water. A southwesterly view for the Antares Cygnus launch. Antares rocket built by Northrop, now Northrop Grumman, used to be Orbital ATK. They were bought out by Northrop Grumman, and they launched the Antares rocket, two-stage rocket to orbit, and on top of that, they put the Cygnus cargo vehicle. So when Cygnus started out, it used to do around 4,500 pounds, and so now they're up to almost, I think it's almost 8,000 pounds. They had an enhanced version of it, a bigger version of Cygnus developed over the years. And it's very versatile, designed for an Antares launch. But, you know, in case there was a problem, they were able to launch on other vehicles, including the Boeing Lockheed or United Launch Alliance rocket, the Atlas V. When Orbital ATK had a problem with their engines years ago, I think it was 2014, and it blew up over the launch pad, they needed a plan B. But because of its versatile ability to go from one rocket to another, they launched a total of 3 Cygnus cargo vehicles on the Atlas V rocket. And they're also planning on launching it in the future on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, because now the new rockets that they've been using for Antares are now going to be changed out. They've changed out to different engines, which are still being developed, and they're not finished yet. So in the meantime, they have a contract with NASA to launch all these cargo vehicles to the International Space Station. They're not going to use the Atlas V anymore, because now that's being phased out. That will be replaced by the Vulcan rocket, which is under development, should fly hopefully by the end of the year. Cygnus will in the future launch on a SpaceX rocket until the new Antares is complete. So more cargo and stuff for the science experiments for the 7 people on board the International Space Station right now. Any comments? Okay. One other topic I wanted to talk about was the Capstone mission report on that. Capstone is the mission by NASA. They contracted with Peter Beck, who owns Rocket Lab, to launch it to the moon about a year ago. So since then, it took about 6 months to get it into its proper orbit. It's a real unusual orbit. It's not just orbiting the moon. It's in what they call a recta heliocentric orbit. They call it a helo orbit. What it does is, it's in a polar orbit, first of all. It's not an equatorial orbit. It's in a polar orbit. And it'll come around by the South Pole every 11 days. And then
that time
move out,
complete.
The distance away, like 40,000 miles away. And then eventually come back and go close to the moon again. And Capstone is a relatively small spacecraft. I think it's only the size of a big suitcase. It's got solar panels. And they had time, a heck of a time getting it operating. Communication problems in the beginning, some little thruster problems. Successfully got into this halo orbit. And the reason they needed this whole thing is because they want to test out that orbit for the future Gateway space station that will eventually be put into that same orbit. Eventually you'll have permanent crews on board the Gateway space station. They'll be there when another crew comes from Earth on an Orion spacecraft and docks with that Gateway space station. They'll be there to help the astronauts get out and hang out in that space station for a little while, and eventually switch over to a lander, a lunar lander. The purpose of the lunar lander will be to disconnect from Gateway and head down to the moon. In the early flights, they'll all be going to the South Pole, setting up a base. That's the plan. And we'll eventually see how that will work out. Artemis 1 has already been successful. That's the one that went up in December, 25 days to the moon and back. Eventually, you're going to have Artemis 2 go up, which will be the end of next year. And they have a crew picked out for that, and a crew of 4. And they won't land on the moon. They'll orbit the moon and then eventually return to Earth. The idea of that is to test out that spacecraft capabilities to support humans, air, food, water. And eventually after that would be Artemis 3. So this is what's on the drawing board for now. Artemis 3 then would, go into orbit around the moon. Actually, the present plan for 3 is Gateway won't be really ready yet. You got Gateway space station. So Artemis 3 is supposed to go directly down to the moon. personally, I'm not crazy about that idea. I'd rather wait for the gateway to be built and utilize that the way Artemis 4 will be. Artemis 4 will be different than 3. They will actually dock with the gateway and be able to do what I said before. Go down on a lander. Lander comes back up. They dock with the gateway. They get back into Orion on the ship that they came from and go back to Earth. And then that lander that came back will eventually be reusable as well. Be able to, you know, use as a shuttle going from gateway down to the moon. We'll see how all these plans that NASA has works out, but that is going to be very interesting the next couple of years to see how this all develops. Any comments? Okay, and you know, part of that success in having a space station around the moon and landing on the moon will be to our engineers and technicians that worked on the Capstone mission. By the way, Capstone is a cislunar autonomous positioning system, technology operations, and navigation experiment spacecraft. Nobody can remember that. I know I can't, but Capstone was a good name. I'm coming to the witching hour here, a little after 11 o'clock, so we'll close the space net portion down for tonight. We'll turn it back to Roy. And of course, tomorrow night we have Club InfoNet on these repeaters, but at 8:30, not at 8 o'clock. This net always comes on at 8 o'clock. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
Thank you, Paul. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul, for the SpaceNet report, for all that you do here on the technical net, and for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I certainly appreciate it a great deal, as I appreciate all the people that participated tonight. We started a little slow, but we built up some speed. If Gary's still out there, if you go to my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, I put up a link to a calculator where you can plug in times and see how time dilates. Unfortunately, you know, just going at 99% of the speed of light is not going to decrease your time sense a little, not that much. It's just for every year you experience, the universe experiences 7 years. You have to go with a bunch more nines after the 99% to get hundreds of thousands of years for every single year that you're living in your spacecraft. Anyway, please keep in mind the links. You can use them any old time. They're active all the time. As always, thanks a lot for coming. Please come next Sunday at 8 when we try and do it all again. Our revels now are done. Keep in mind what Dick always used to say, be kind to each other. It's always good advice. A word of wisdom from philosopher Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep an open mind to new and interesting facts and discussions. Try and learn something new every day. Have a great week. Have fun. Enjoy yourself. Stay safe. Be well. And please join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. where we will do it all over again, or at least try to. This is ACGS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. And I am clear after I say, Slava Ukraine.
Hey, Roy. One comment about the Ukraine.
Yes, Paul.
There's an Episcopalian church out by me. I ride past it all the time. Anyway, they have naturally an American flag, but they also have a Ukrainian flag up there. I don't know if that's pop one of the around the country or not, but I was glad to see that right by the lake.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, I try and keep up with what's going on there. It's been particularly bad lately. The Russians really didn't appreciate them bombing their bridge, so they're taking out on all places. And every so often I'll buy little knickknacks from the Ukraine. I got a little keychain made out of repurposed iron from a Russian tank that they destroyed. Unfortunately, I apparently got on some kind of a mailing list. So I keep on getting these advertisements for little dummies of Putin getting hung on one of those devices with a bit of rope and such. It's not terribly attractive to look at.
Okay. What thing you're going to wind up on? Yeah. And you know, like Google. You know, when I go to Google, and you know, all the different topics that they have for their news. You know, I used to get, you know, a variety of everything. You know, everything from tires to beer and to stories about, how to cut your lawn. You know, and you know, I kept clicking on base topics. You know, as the months went by and the years went by when I first got the computer. And now the only thing that ever pops up on that computer are space topics. That's it. You know, I don't see anything about politics, nothing. It's really weird, you know. But that's what happens. You know, once they get your number, that's it.
Yeah, they think it's intelligent. They put cookies all over the place on your computer, and they try and figure out where you focus your attention. And unfortunately, they seem to be more obsessed than we are, so it kind of over-focuses on subject matters.
I agree. The other day I was playing around. Years ago, I used to be able to take a hearing test on a computer, you know, just find out, how many cycles you could hear. And I remember Eric used to talk about this thing all the time, and brought it up, and I remember playing around with it and, you know, taking the test. But now, recently, I tried to do that. Every one of the tests, I must have went to 15 different sites just for the heck of it. Most of them want your email and all. And you also have to accept their cookies, which I'm not going to accept. You know, then I'm going to be stuck with advertisements and everything from them. So you really can't do that anymore, you know, which is a shame, you know. I don't know, no big deal. You go to the doctor and you get a test, but it was pretty cool to be able to do that on a computer years ago. And, you know, Eric, he was hard of hearing, and he would talk about this. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's a shame that there's no privacy. They used to grab your cookies without asking permission, but so they passed laws that now the boxes pop up. You could also try it on applications. I don't know if you have an Android phone. I have a Apple phone, and there's all kinds of function generator capabilities where, you know, I used to try and figure out where the high end of my hearing stopped. You know, it used to be 12,000, then it went down to about 10,000.
Yeah. And I would imagine, well, on the Android, the sites I went to, you're really supposed to put earphones on, you know, of some sort, which I have. You know, I was doing it on my laptop. Pretty cool. You know, some of them you get through the test, but they won't give you the results until you tell them what your blood test is, blood type, and, you know, how many kids you got. It's really bizarre, but I did one test. It was pretty good, you know. But you can't get the results.
Yeah, it's a shame, but I mean, it's a money thing. That's how they make their money. They collect data about individuals on the internet, and they sell it to brokers that pass it around. And every so often, you can kind of do searches to see what the internet thinks of you. And it could be surprising.
Yeah, how true. And the same with the weather apps. I would have great weather sites years ago. I mean, they gave you every kind of information. No advertisements. You know, some of them were, I don't know what colleges were. I don't know where they were coming from. They were just, everything was free, you know, and without advertisement. Now, you know, I mean, you get a decent radar. I have to go to the Weather Channel app.